Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is true crime time, although true crime time has kind of turned into Hollywood noir crime time. Once again, I am joined by Jen. Jen, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
Good, good. You know, I saw a suggestion. I've seen a lot of suggestions about things that we should talk about. And one was Marilyn Monroe, and at some point, I guess we're going to actually have to do that. I just feel as if it would take us about 16 episodes.
Yeah, that might be a series.
That, you know, that's kind of like a whole, you know, sub-series of the thing. And then I saw somebody else wanted us to alternate with, like, the noir thing and then a true crime, more modern day kind of thing.
Okay.
So maybe we could do something like that too. I don't know. I really enjoy these Hollywood things. And I was telling Jen, before we started recording that this person that we picked this week, despite how famous she is in the annals of history and what she accomplished, I don't think I had ever heard of her. Maybe in the back of my mind, the name has come through. And talking about Isadora Duncan, who I would say is the founder of the modern dance movement. Would you call it that?
Yeah, after reading about her, yeah, world-class dancer and definitely one of the founding people. You know, her feet alone were insured by Lloyd's of London before anyone else's feet were really insured, you know, in the dance world. You know, let's just concentrate on that genre. So, yeah, I think that she was, you know, very cutting edge back then.
It was, you know, and I think even nowadays when people think of dance, you know, on theater, most people think still of, you know, ballet and stuff like that. And the modern dance kind of still, I think, takes a little bit of a secondary kind of note to it. And even back then, she was pushing the boundaries and people didn't exactly understand what they were seeing. And I think part of the issue was she was a little bit odd.
She was odd. And for the times that she was dancing in, you know, dancing barefoot, showing your belly, showing any type of skin was really frowned upon. And she didn't see a problem with it. So she just continued to do it. A lot of countries had banned her. And the ones that didn't, you know, she would go there, perform, and then continue to push the envelope.
And her sibling was just as odd. And when I was reading this and researching, I was thinking to myself, okay, this time period that we're talking about is the equivalent to, say, when Downton Abbey was going on. And I just think about that show and, oh my gosh, it would be the biggest scandal if somebody ever had sex before they got married. And I mean, these people were just having sex with everybody all the time. And it's just a complete 180 from, you know, anything that you would see on Downton Abbey. And it's a completely different kind of lifestyle.
Yeah. People were doing the same stuff back then that they were doing now. It's just no one was talking about it.
Guess not. So why don't you tell us about the death of Isadora Duncan, which is one of the most remarkable deaths, if it happened as the story goes, than I have ever heard. It is Final Destination worthy, and I am shocked that Jeffrey Reddick, who is a subscriber to the podcast and the creator of Final Destination, did not use this death because it is something incredible. So go ahead and tell everybody about it.
Okay. Her Final Destination begins September 14th of 1927. So this is really, really old death. That's why some of the details are a little sketchy, but we pulled as much as we could. Again, she was a passenger in an open automobile. So just figure like an open style, like carriage type automobile. She was wearing this really long scarf and she had it wound all around her neck, trailing behind her. And the sad thing for her was that it was hanging off the edge of the automobile. And as the automobile began moving, the scarf became wound up in the spoke wheel of the automobile. So before she knew it, she was strangled and asphyxiated and then also almost decapitated as she was flung to the cobble street. So people started asking, you know, is the tale of it being a freak accident, is that a real thing? Or was it politics? Was it her personal life? You know, what's going on with Isadora Duncan?
It must have been the strongest scarf in the world. I feel as if, you know, to get wrapped, first of all, it had to be the longest scarf in the world.
And I saw some photos. It is long.
Is it?
It is.
You know, I know that some of the notes you sent me talked about that somebody, you know, bought the death scarf. But I was reading an article that somebody had written. It was an interview, and apparently there are shreds of the scarf still in a library, and for anybody really to see. It's just... Well,
that is good that you brought that up, because there are two different theories as to what happened here. And so if there is a shredded scarf out there, it kind of goes to prove the theory that there was a crowd that came up to her and began tearing at her neck, trying to get the scarf off. You know, that would cause it to tatter. Some people say that never even happened, you know, that the scarf was auctioned off and it was intact. So I'm glad that you brought that up.
It was just a few threads, and I'm forgetting. It was an interview, and it was an interview on Lenny Letter. I remember that, but I don't remember the title of the interview. But at the very end, it was just somebody who had written a book or something about Isadora, and not Mary Destey, but somebody who had written a book or an article about her and had done some research. And they said, yeah, you know, down at the bottom of this pile, there was this envelope, and inside the envelope were, you know, red threads.
Interesting.
From the scarf. Yeah. So,
okay, well, let me ask you this, because I'm old. I'm like 100. But you know what? You're older. So were the Amel cars or the old man's Bugatti back then, could they have continued to roll with something like the scarf being wound up in the spokes? Would that not cause the wheel well to just stop?
You would think so. I just, it's such a bizarre death. And one of the interviews I read was another researcher was, you know, that her mom had always said, make sure you take your scarf off before you get in a convertible or you could die like Isadora Duncan. So it is something that I guess is known through history. However, as I said at the beginning, I know the name, I guess, but if you had said, well, who's Isadora Duncan, I would have no clue. I couldn't answer it, but I would say that I'd probably heard the name, but... And definitely no association with the most bizarre death ever.
Oh, yeah. In medical journals, you know, there is such a thing as the Isadora Duncan strangulation death method. I mean, you find this in just very professional places. And I never knew who she was either. And I had been in school and heard about her.
She grew up. Well, when she was born, I guess her dad at that point, when she was born, just barely. You know, he still had money. He was nearly 60 years old when she was born, which, okay. And what also freaks me out, and we'll talk about him in a little bit, is after he left Isadora and her siblings and the mom, he went on and had more kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I was cranking them out late in age.
He was. So right after Isadora was born, her dad... what I saw was exposed to illegal bank dealings, and the family became extremely poor. So I don't know if he was the one doing the illegal bank dealings, or he was just caught up in them and as a result ended up broke. I'm not 100% sure on that. Did you see anything about that at all?
Nope. Didn't go down that rabbit hole. So no finance here.
So she had three other siblings. The only one that I really care about talking about a little bit later is Raymond Duncan, who was even more, I don't know, free-spirited. I'll use that word. And also...
Is that what we're calling it?
I have to talk about Raymond here for a second, because when I... There was pictures of him too, which I found, oh good, you know, I think he essentially started a cult. Would we consider this a cult that he had?
Yes. And also, if you want to know what he looks like, Elizabeth Smart's abductor comes to mind.
Oh, you know? Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. So he dressed, now you're thinking about Paris in, the late 20s, and everybody is, you know, dressed fashionably and things like this. And Raymond Duncan, who had spent some time in Greece, had his hair really, really long and only wore togas and sandals. That's all he wore. And, you know, to see that kind of sight and people in Paris would, you know, instantly knew who he was because, you know, who was this guy who was wearing, you know, the togas and the sandals. But these sandals, the Duncan sandals, you can still find those in New York because he went back to New York and taught people how to make these sandals. He would make them. And there are still, you know, sandal making shops or leather shops that make sandals in this style because apparently they are the bomb. So, but there was it's just, if you Google his picture, you'll see what I'm talking about. And you're just thinking, okay, well, this guy is a little bit odd. And he also said that he only ate lettuce, celery, beets, turnips, walnuts, almonds, and fruit. That's it. And, oh, and some beans. And, you know, that he hadn't eaten meat since they had, the family had been to Chicago and he saw, the processing plants, which if you've ever read Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, and if he got to see that, then I totally understand where he's coming from. But he started this academy, he called it an academy, and it was essentially, like I said, a cult. Because the premier subject that he would talk about was the sexuality of the future. And he was essentially a polygamist. You know, he had a wife named, I think Penelope, and then she died, and then he married one of his students, and it seems that he would get most of his students pregnant, and then when they would get pregnant, he didn't want them any longer, even though he had told them if they got pregnant that he would take care of them. So, he was not the nicest guy in the whole world. No. So let's talk about Isadora. And I'm trying to think how we should go about this because I want to talk about her death and there's so many questions about it.
Okay. Why don't we tell them what happened, you know, who was driving, what happened, and then we'll kind of go through, you know, what.
You have this mechanic, Benoit Falchetto. He's French and Italian, so he's got the Benoit, but then he's got the Falchetto. And he was driving, and he was, I guess, further up. And she had pushed the seat back, so he couldn't actually see, he said, what was going on. And the scarf was red because Isadora was a communist. To the point where she had lost her U.S. citizenship and had lived in the Soviet Union for a while and had a school there. But this person that had given her the scarf was a woman by the name of Mary. Well, she went by Mary Desty. Her real name's Mary Dempsey. And she is a piece of work unto herself. And I guess she had been upset because Isadora had said, I'm off to go have sex or something like that. And some people say, well, no, she said something else. But Mary Desty says that Isadora had said, let's go have sex or something like that, talking about the mechanic. And she had also said that Isadora was suicidal. Do you think that she was suicidal?
No, I think that was something that was made up after the death. That's always something that I found to be suspicious.
And what would it, you know, so what if she was suicidal? That to me, so was she intentionally wrapped it around her neck and then tied it to the spoke? You know, I just, Isadora lived every day like it was her last. Obviously she didn't have any money at this time. She was essentially just borrowing from every single rich friend that she had. And when I say borrowing, I'm putting in quotes because she was never going to pay anybody back. And she was generally drunk, but everybody in Paris knew her. F. Scott Fitzgerald once, you know, talked about her and watched her being drunk and things like that, walking down the streets of Paris. And there, you know, there was a dwindling number of people that were giving her money. But to me, when I was reading it all, she didn't seem suicidal. She was just enjoying her life.
Yeah, if she was ever going to be at a point in her life where she was suicidal, it would have been in 1913 when she lost her children you know, when they rolled into the river and drowned. You know, she made it through that. So why all these years later would she be suicidal, you know, then?
And she went through a tough time with that. And, you know, the crazy, crazy deaths associated with her. Because people, there was this curse that was supposedly brought upon her and her family. And we can talk about that. There's a couple of actresses who may or may not have put this curse on, suspects in regards to this curse. However, she had an ex-husband who died from a questionable hanging 2 years prior to her death. His ex-girlfriend hung herself by his graveside. And then in 1913, two of Isidore's children and their nanny were killed in an automobile accident where the chauffeur, I guess, cranked the car, because back then you had to go out front and you had to crank it. But he got out of the car. So maybe he was cranking it from the inside, but he got out and just watched as the driverless automobile started to roll, and then it went off a bridge into the Seine River in Paris. And the windows were rolled up, and everybody watched the occupants inside the automobile banging on the glass before they drowned. Now, he was charged with negligent homicide, but that was horribly tragic. Then, you know, one of the things that I discovered after that was right after that. So in 1913, they got killed. And there is a story in her autobiography where she said that she begged a young Italian stranger, the sculptor Romano Romanelli, to sleep with her because she was desperate for another baby. She got pregnant by him and gave birth to a son in August of 1914, but then that infant died shortly after birth. Her dad, along with his third wife and their daughter, died in 1898 when the British passenger steamer ran aground off the coast of England. And in 1921, it was her nephew. So Raymond's son, he ran away because he didn't want to be with Raymond anymore, because Raymond had a cult. And I think he even called it that. And that the whole point of the cult was to lure in women to get them pregnant. Oh, it just, I mean, just some crazy, crazy stuff that went on with this family. And it all, she said it was a curse. And the person who's talked about the curse, I think, was Mary Desty, though.
She's the most vocal party.
Yeah, to the curse. And apparently what it was there were two possibilities that people have kind of tracked down. And one was this actress named Helen Gardner, who was basically the screen's first vamp. And that's what Desty called this person who did the curse, was a vamp. And Helen Gardner was the first Cleopatra on film. And she had a lover who was the director, Charles Gaskell. And Charles Gaskell ended up sleeping with Isidore Duncan. And then there was a different actress called Theda Bara, and she also had a lover that Isadora had slept with too. Everybody wanted to sleep with Isadora Duncan, I guess. So either one of these people, could have put this curse. One of the things is that, Theda Bara is more likely than Helen Gardner, because Preston Sturges, who you guys might know, who won an Academy Award, is the son of Mary Desty, and he wrote about his meeting with Theda Bara when he was a child, and he said that Bara told him about her kind of unusual power, and that she could feel persons' presence like tigers feel their prey, and that she could write down the messages from spirits while holding her hand over her eyes. So these were some creepy people.
Yeah, she's interesting. She said that Isadora had taught her how to walk and talk Serpentine. Is that something that you are aware of?
Like serpentine, like a snake maybe or something?
Yeah.
Like
oh, so they are just kind of speaking in tongues and doing a serpent dance?
Yeah, you know, that's kind of what I got from that. I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but when it said Serpentin, I mean, I didn't look it up.
No, that makes sense, because I was reading this article en français, so that is probably exactly what they're talking about.
There you go, en français. But anyway, so Mary had this kid, Preston Sturges, and he won the first ever Academy Award for an original screenplay. And it was for The Great McGinty. And then he also, in the same year, got two more Oscar nominations for writing. So that has only happened one, two, three other times. Frank Butler, Francis Ford Coppola, and Oliver Stone. So, you know, that's kind of interesting. And his kid, Preston Sturges' kid, is Tom Sturges, who has had a huge career in the music business. He signed Smashing Pumpkins, Outkast, let's see. Oh, and then he was with Clive Davis at Arista, and, you know, so this guy's got just a huge history in music. He signed Three Doors Down, he signed 50 Cent, Foo Fighters, Stone Temple Pilots. I mean, this guy is, you know, big time in the music industry. So it's interesting that his grandmother is, you know, Mary Desty, and this whole kind of strange kind of thing. I had never heard of Mary Desty. I'd obviously heard of Preston Sturges and I heard of Tom Sturges, but oh, that Mary Desty is quite the character. And it wouldn't surprise me if she's the one who put a curse on.
I'm side-eyeing her. She seems like someone that would be very into gossip. You know, her story has changed a couple of times over the years. You know, different reporters would ask her what happened, because she's allegedly one of the only witnesses, her and at least one other male outside of the driver, because, you know, as Duncan fell out the back, the driver, he didn't see any of this occur anyways, but two people behind them claim they did.
And also, they weren't going very fast.
No, I mean, all of this happened. I mean, would you say it was just within a couple of minutes? I mean, how long does it take you to go maybe 10 yards? Because it seems like 10 is the most popular calculation.
Yeah. And so, okay. So this car, whether or not it was a Bugatti or not, is up for discussion. As you found, Bugatti said it on their own website that it was their car. They've since taken that down.
Oh, yeah. That is just a massive debate among car lovers. Just that debate by itself is heated. So, yeah, we'll just say, you know, it doesn't matter what type of car. It was an open vehicle. And they typically both kind of ran the same back then, right?
You're right. And 1927, I mean, how fast is this car taking off? And remember, it's only gone 10 yards.
Yep, so 10 yards.
30 feet. And this was enough in the 30 feet where this guy was going fast enough where it managed to wrap itself around, tighten around her neck, yank her out of the car onto the ground, all in 30 feet.
And cause instant death as she hits the ground.
So, you know, with this car, when it starts off in 10 yards, to me, you'd have to be going at least 30 miles an hour, I would think, for something like that to happen.
Yeah. Would it take 30 miles per hour for the scarf to actually fly in the wind? Because if you listen to Mary Desty, she says that the scarf was flying in the wind. So that seems like a good rate of speed, you know, to pick up that heavy scarf, because the autopsy report and all that talks about how heavy the articles of clothing that she wore were.
Yeah, so it's flowing in the wind. And she sees it flowing in the wind, and this is all in 10 yards. And everybody, like you said, is pretty much agreed that they only went 10 yards. So she sees it blowing in the wind. And then in this, I mean, it's 30 feet. So in the space of this, she sees it blowing in the wind. Then at some point in this 30 feet, it goes down to the spokes, wraps itself around in the spokes, tightens around her neck, almost decapitates her, throws her out, all in 30 feet.
And the driver has no idea this is going on. And the people, you know, what, they can't yell that far to let her know that it's hanging off the side of the car. She can't hear them.
And did Mary ever say that she shouted a warning or anything?
She claims she shouted a warning and that, Duncan didn't hear her. But Mary heard her say something like, "Farewell, my friends, I'm off to glory." Some people will say that Duncan said, "Farewell, my friends, I'm off to love." So either way.
Or a tryst.
Yeah, or a tryst.
You know, so again.
So they could hear each other.
Yeah, that's the other thing. So I'm just not sure about it.
The reason I ask is because as she is falling out of this vehicle and getting asphyxiated and everything else horrible that's happening to her, I mean, she knew what was happening right before she died. The driver, she's sitting directly behind him. He hears nothing, yet Mary Dusty claims that she heard just terrible screaming. She heard more screaming when the woman hit the pavement. I mean, how would you not hear it if it came from directly behind you as the driver?
I know. See, that's kind of the part that I don't understand. And then let's talk about her and Aleister Crowley. A lot of you might not know who Aleister Crowley is. He is an occultist. Many people call him like a Satan worshiper. He would disagree with that. But they met at a party in 1910. Isadora was there and Mary Dusty was there. And the next thing you know, Mary Dusty and Aleister Crowley are having an affair. And Dusty is in this book called Moonchild. She is Lisa La Gifrea, Gifrea in the book. And also Isadora is in it as Lavinia King. That's his name for her in this book. And Mary became a member of Crowley's occult order, which is kind of weird. And he gained widespread notoriety during his life because he did recreational drugs. He was bisexual, a social critic. He had been called the wickedest man in the world, labeled as a Satanist by the press. And he has remained this kind of influential figure and is considered still to be a prophet in Thelema. And, you know, his sexuality kind of played an important part. He outlined three forms of sex magic. He called magic M-A-G-I-C-K. And there was autoerotic, homosexual, and heterosexual, and argued that such acts could be used to focus the magician's will onto a specific goal, such as financial gain or personal creative success. He said that sex was a sacrament, with the consummation of sexual fluids interpreted as a Eucharist, and was often manifested as the cakes of light, a biscuit containing either menstrual blood or a mixture of semen and vaginal fluids. Yeah. That's
okay.
I know. So this is the kind of person that Mary was with for well over a year. So to me, in this kind of thing, she could certainly have been involved in it. Now, like I said, he said that he didn't consider himself a Satanist, and he said he didn't worship Satan. However, he used satanic imagery. He called himself the B666. He called himself the Whore of Babylon in his work. He would send anti-Christmas cards to his friends. And, you know, this was a guy that was not nice. And Mary said that she used to exchange electricity with him, and that Mary was Alistair's second of 11 scarlet women. And I don't understand all this stuff, but established the magical link with the Praetor Human Minds that inspired him with one of his greatest works, Book 4 or Liber ABA. I don't even know what that is. And Mary would tell him what to write. She had these visions. So it seems to me that the people that Isadora was kind of associating with, whether it's that Theta Bera or Mary, you know, they were involved in some crazy, crazy satanic stuff.
Yeah, they were definitely dealing with the dark side of the occult.
And then it makes me think, okay, could she have killed somebody? And I feel as if she probably could have. When Preston talked about Aleister Crowley, Preston said that he disliked Crowley for his bizarre appearance and unusual activities. And I realized my mother and I were lucky to escape with our lives. If I had been a little older, he might not have escaped with his. So, you know, there's obviously some dark stuff, and maybe he thought that Aleister was going to murder them or sacrifice them. I'm not sure.
It seems like that she knew a lot about some dark stuff and even murders. You know, maybe even ones she didn't eyewitness, because her ex-husband, Sergei Yasnin, who killed himself by allegedly hanging, mm-hmm. and that whole thing is just suspicious. Anyways, he was a part of this whole, like, the joint state political doctorate party was looking after him, which was like the secret police of Russia. And it was because his wife, Duncan, had said that she knew something about the royal Russian murders, and that she was going to write an autobiography, and also an autobiography with him, since he was a famous poet. And they were going to tell the story of what happened. And of course, the Russian leaders were like, no, you're not.
Yeah, because, when I read that, it made me, nowadays we know that the Russian royal family was all murdered, and there was always these conspiracy theories about whether or not one of them lived to grow up and be somebody else.
Exactly.
I think it was Anastasia or something. So, but I don't think anybody at this time really knew the details, except for maybe, so Isadora knew them and was going to write about them, and the government obviously didn't want her to write about them. So there's three theories, for the most part, about her death. There's the official one, which is that her death was caused by the scarf that stuck in the wheel of the car, right?
Correct.
That's number one. The second one we kind of talked about is that Isadora was cursed. I'm not big on curses. However, there were so many bad things that happened in her life after she met Mary Esty. The only one that really didn't was her dad died before she had met Mary Esty. But everything else, all of these horrible things, happened after she met her.
Correct.
Most of them happened after Mary had started sleeping with Aleister Crowley. Because that happened in 1910, and most of these bad things that happened to Isadora happened after 1910. So, you have this dark kind of spirit and everything hanging. Again, curses.
Do you think that curses can manipulate you into believing bad things are coming? That you can kind of manifest them in your mind. If you think hard enough that this person says, I'm cursed and bad things are going to happen, then every day, does it kind of become mind over matter? And then bad things can happen. And then you start to just blame them on that.
Yeah. And then maybe you're manifesting all these bad thoughts onto the people that are closest to you. And these things happen. Let's talk about the chauffeur who was charged with negligent homicide. I did not see what happened to him. I don't know if he was found guilty or anything like that. I just saw that he was charged with negligent homicide.
Per the historic newspapers, that he was charged and then found guilty.
Okay, good. As he should have been. But here's my thing, is I wonder if he could have been not paid to murder them, right? But this is a guy who cranks the car and then gets out of the car and they're on a bridge.
Who would do that with kids in the car?
Exactly, but maybe he thought, this is where I'm going with this, maybe he thought that he had been cursed or put under some kind of spell. And he believed it. That was kind of my first thought, because I'm just thinking, okay, there's a guy on a bridge. He's cranking the car.
Did he think by allowing them to roll into the river, then somehow that would lift the curse off of him?
Or maybe he wasn't cursed, but he was told, like, he was put under a spell to do a certain action. And he believed that he was under the spell. And so he did it. And then what that does is it just reaffirms to Isadora that she's cursed.
There could have been a lot of that. Like, anytime people start talking about curses and things like that, I mean, they're mind games. I mean, just
exactly.
Number one, they're,
yeah,
they're complete mind,
100%.
Someone messing with you.
But don't you have, arguably, the world's greatest mind screwer?
Absolutely.
In Aleister Crowley.
Yes,
you
do. He knows all about, people want to scream MK Ultra. Yeah, this is the step beyond that. Yes, he knows how to control you, manipulate you, and make you feel the way he wants you to feel.
Exactly.
So, yeah, she was in his clutches.
Yes. So you had Aleister and you had Mary. To me, Aleister could probably convince the chauffeur. Again, it's all mind games. Hey, whatever he wanted him to do. And the chauffeur just susceptible, and Aleister knew what to do. He's controlling all these people, and he's controlling people still long, long after his death by the things that he did.
Absolutely.
And it was Mary in her book that started talking about the curse and had said, a very famous film vamp. But again, she doesn't name the person. And I'm not sure why she didn't. Maybe she thought, oh, I'll get sued for saying that somebody put her under a curse. And the story goes that Mary said, well, Mary and Isadora were riding in a car with this actress and her young man. And in both cases that I talked about earlier, the story is that Isadora had slept with both of, you know, the actresses, the two actresses or choices had slept with each of their lovers. And Mary says that Isadora had just, quote, packed off a man and that his only salvation was in getting away from the vamp. So again, using kind of suggestions or mind things, you know, hey, you know, you really should get away from this, this vamp. And, you know, so kind of putting suggestions. So again, you have this kind of screwing around with the mind thing. And that, and then Mary said that he was in a highly nervous state owing to the girl's spiritualistic experiments. And that the famous vamp rose suddenly and majestically to her feet in the car, got to her feet, and screamed, "You have taken my mate from me. What about my child?" And there wasn't any child, but Isadora didn't know this and answered that she would take care of the girl and her child. And then the vamp said, "I curse you. The gods of my fathers curse you and your children forever." And then Mary said the years after this event, is of course when it's the same car. I got the feeling that it was the same car that this had happened in, was the car that Isadora's children had drowned in.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me. And even right after that woman cursed them, if it's even a woman. See, I question that situation because the person was never named. And if she was in a relationship with Crowley, wouldn't she go and say, how do I fix this? You know, does this woman, is there any way, you know, that we can kind of block her, you know, bind her, whatever the terminology is. And he would have fixed it, right? Because he loved Isadora Duncan. So, yeah. I mean, I just question if it was a female at all. But shortly after that, before her children are drowned in that river, she herself was involved in an auto accident to where her face and her head, you know, she suffered lacerations. And like I was saying about the Lloyds of London guaranteeing her feet, they didn't really care if her face was okay. They just asked her, you know, just tell us about her feet. You know, that was in the newspaper everywhere, just flashes about, you know, the feet. So she had even that happen to her, you know, just a dark cloud after that just followed her everywhere.
Yeah. So, you know, Mary, in this book that she wrote, she could have been blaming it on an unnamed actress, a vamp, when in fact it was Mary who had been doing all the suggesting and using Alistair and for whatever reasons to get at Isadora. Because it seems to me that they were just screwing around with Isadora's head.
Yeah, this is just manipulation central. You know, Isadora talks about trying to bring home, it seems like it was a director, you know, maybe it could have been a producer. It's historic newspaper, so it's sketchy. But she tries to bring this guy home, and Mary Destey is in the picture again. And she said, "I'm not allowed to like this guy, so, you know, I basically have to run him off." So it talks about how Duncan and Destey, they run around the house naked while this guy is over. And I don't know if he's naked or what, but they run around and they're blowing out these black candles every time they circle him. And he gets so freaked out that he just runs out of the house. And he's like, "I don't want anything to do with either of you." So that's just more of that black magic type stuff.
Exactly. And I feel as if there was so much of that going on. And that people, as you said, it just, you know, it's so suggestible. And Aleister Crowley knew what he was doing, that you just start to believe it. And you start to manifest it. And it just, it consumes you. And to me, that is a more likely kind of theory. And then there's a third theory about her death, and you kind of mentioned it before, and it was written kind of by this author Valentina Pashnina, and she wrote a book called The Unknown Essenin, who was a poet and the ex-husband of Isadora. And so you had Isadora, who's this communist, self-professed communist, despite the fact that she seemed to have these really, really high tastes for everything. But she had spent, like you said, going around Russia, and she saw, you know, the hunger, the homeless children, families without homes, lawlessness, thieves, you know, things like this. And so she kind of watched that. And she said, hey, the government, you guys are all living large, but the people are not. And she said, you know, that she hadn't met a real Bolshevik and all this kind of stuff, and that they didn't help her with the dance school, and all she had wanted with the dance school was she just wanted some food for her students, some electricity, some water, a salary for the teachers, and some clothing for costumes.
Yeah, that seems simple enough, right?
Yeah. And then because of the fact that she was going to write this autobiography, that, you know, that they wanted to kill her.
Yeah, she had passed, like 1 month before her death, she had started passing papers for her autobiography to a new guy that was going to write her memoir. And his name was Van Zhusha. And he was also Russian. He was also killed in an automobile crash a month after she died. And the papers that were allegedly supposed to be tucked in a briefcase in his vehicle, they were removed and they never surfaced again after that.
In the later stages of her life, when people were loaning her money, everybody wanted her to write an autobiography because they felt, okay, if she writes an autobiography, then she'll have enough money to live on for the rest of her life because people would buy it. So they kept saying, write your autobiography, write your autobiography. And, you know, so she marries this guy. I think it was 1922 they married. And he, the poet, was 18 years younger than Isadora. And he went with her on a tour of Europe and the United States. But by May 1923, so just a year later, he left Isadora and returned to Moscow. And then a couple of years later, he was found dead in his room in, you know, an apparent suicide.
Hung by a belt, and the belt mysteriously disappeared.
Yeah, I definitely think that he was murdered. for sure, you know, but he had been in the last couple of years of his life, he had been, you know, using drugs, boozing it up, and he had these explosive kind of scenes in restaurants, and he trashed hotel rooms, and he also, you know, was writing his best poetry at this time. And he went to a mental institution, and he had cut his wrists and wrote a suicide note in his own blood. So, you know,
it was another case of someone just getting so wrapped up in politics that he always thought that men were watching him, you know, because at a time in his life, people were watching him. They did go in on him. They had a search warrant, you know, however they obtained that in Russia, and they trashed his whole flat. Whatever they found did make them follow him for a little bit. He called them the secret agents. You know, I don't know how long that actually went on, but maybe it made him crazy.
So they said, so this Pashnina, in her book, says that there was this guard named Peter Morgani and his companion, this Van Zhusha person, and that when Isadora was going to sit in the car, she somebody offered her a coat and the driver his jacket, but she refused. So her body only had the woolen shawl, which Duncan usually wore. And then this guy, Ivan, who followed her to the car, threw a shawl on her shoulders, not listening to her protest. So I don't know. You know, it just, I'm not sure how that all played out. To me, that kind of seems a little bit more far-fetched than something like Mary. You know, so you only had the two witnesses, because you had the driver who says he didn't see anything because he was too far up. I don't know how far up you could be in this little tiny sports car. And then you had Mary Desty and Peter Morgani. And Morgani wrote about this wild crowd, but Mary said that there wasn't, right?
Right.
That there was nobody there.
Right.
So to me, a wild crowd and not anybody there, how can you confuse the two?
The same way that they confuse for years the fact that she was dead when she hit the pavement, and she was dead on arrival when any type of EMT service tried to go and get her. But Mary Desty will tell you that she heard her scream not only from the buggy, but also as she fell to the pavement. And then, I don't know, some type of sad, I don't know, cries maybe from the pavement right before she perished. And the doctors in the autopsy reporters, they call them autopsy surgeons. I always love that. They said, no, you know, she was not alive to have made any of those noises.
Exactly. And it was Morgani who said that he described Duncan as a sad woman with red eyes. But Mary said that Duncan was cheerful and carefree. So, I don't know. You know, it's just...
So she's cheerful and she's carefree, yet she wanted to die just prior to, to entering the vehicle. Like, that doesn't even go together.
I know. And not much is known about Peter Morgani. Some people say that he was Isidore's Russian secretary. You know, I'm not sure exactly, you know, who he is. It's just, to me, this is kind of, I feel it's all on Mary. And what I'm just trying to figure out, how she could have done it. You know,
well, the only way she could have done it is to absolutely, and then, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and just totally jump in on this. You would had to have wrapped that person with the scarf and made sure that you left enough link, you know, near the tire to where the spoke could actually catch it and start winding itself. I mean, that would have to be really thought out.
Do you think that, okay, well, what about this? What about if, you know, Mary tells the driver to start making out with Isidore or something, and Isidore's got the scarf, and then Mary goes and ties it to the spokes.
See,
but then again,
yeah.
would you even think that that is going to kill her? Because to me, it doesn't sound like a way that somebody could die.
To me, it doesn't either. That's why I was anxious to talk about this. But it all depends on getting someone that actually knows the rate of speed they were actually traveling at and how far did it actually go. Because I could totally be on board with this freakish death occurring if, you know, Isidore and the guy are making out. You know, the scarf's already... This is what the autopsy report says. It says, an immensely long, iridescent, hand-painted, heavy scarf wrapped about her neck, streaming in long folds around her neck over and over again, swathed about her body. Okay, so if something like that got caught up in anything, yes, it would pull you out if you were traveling at a high rate of speed. So that woman would have had to have taken some of that scarf, like you said, tie it around the spokes, tie it around the wheel, something to ensure that their plan was guaranteed to work out. Because if not, you know, her and this guy making out would have just, I don't know, been off on their journey. You know, how is it so foolproof?
Yeah, it's not. And in the autopsy, it also says the automobile was moving at full speed. So in this 10 yards, they went full speed, I guess.
What is now, full speed in an ammo car or in a Bugatti from that time?
I don't know.
Maybe it's someone's comment below. If you're a car person, let us know.
Because to me, it's like, oh, you know, 30 miles an hour. But again, if you've only gone 10 yards, are you getting up to the 30 or 40 or whatever it was capable of doing?
I don't see it. I even looked at some car videos and looked at some car deaths and statistics. And yes, y'all, I go that far. And I cannot make sense of this.
Now, one thing they said in the autopsy was she was dragged for several yards before Mr. Falchetto halted. Now, what made him halt?
Exactly. Is that the point in time that the wheel well stopped working? I mean,
you know,
did he not hear the thump, thump, thump? You know,
right.
You would hear something in a little car like that. They weren't built like they are today. You know,
first of all, it's a convertible. And yes, he says that he was in front of her. But all of a sudden, you know, she goes flying out. And then the scarf apparently still tied to the spokes, right? So then he's pulling them along, I guess. And maybe he realized, oh, what's going on? And then stopped. But she was probably already dead by that point, I'm guessing.
Yeah. They wrote an autopsy. There was nothing to be made of her. As everyone stood over the cobblestone, death had immediately occurred.
So she flies out. So it's hard for me to imagine it. It's because let's say it is tied. So then it's wrapping and wrapping and wrapping around her tighter and tighter. But again, we've only gone 10 yards. So I don't know.
I wonder if she started to, you know, your first reaction when you're being strangled to death is to take your hands and try to relieve yourself of whatever's happening. I wonder if she grabbed the scarf and then started to lean towards the way in which she was being pulled. And then that's how she fell out. you know, because they're not traveling at a high rate of speed. So maybe she just kind of went with it, you know, just kind of dumped herself out, hoping that that would relieve the strangulation. She was almost decapitated by that point, so it wouldn't have helped her. But maybe that's what she did, because it doesn't say that they hit a bump or anything that threw her out.
Well, it's cobblestones, though.
Yeah, so, it is. So you're getting a little da-dun-da-dun-da-dun.
But you don't think that maybe she, like, smacks, you know, the falchetto guy and says, you know, look, and have him stop?
I mean, like you said, she's sitting behind him per the incident report, but it's not that far. Because even how Bugattis, you know, how the seats sit in Bugattis or in the Amol cars, you can still reach out and smack someone. She could have hit the guy upside the back of the head and be like, hello, I'm dying here.
I know. You know, that's, I just.
Or maybe she did. And he was like, this is what's supposed to happen. Just saying.
I know. It's just, it is crazy. So a couple things. So what, how do you think that she died? I mean, do we think that she died? Okay. Let's say there wasn't a crowd. Let's say they set it up and they did it as, I actually feel that that is the way that she died. I just feel that some of the statistics, were manipulated by, the witnesses and, you know, to make it look like an accident rather than a murder. To me, it is the hardest to believe death I've ever read about. If the 10 yards is accurate, it's impossible to me, it seems. It's like Jeffrey
Epstein.
That's
where I'm at on this. Yeah, there's just a perfect storm of things that do not make sense. And at that rate of speed, you would need some help. It's almost like she was set up to fail. So that's where I'm at on this. Her friends set her up to fail.
Yeah, I think so. And I think she was in with wrong people who were only looking out for themselves and were messing with her mind and enjoying it.
Yeah, these people were just too dark for her.
Yeah. So one thing I want to mention before we go is when I was reading it and I was talking about when I was reading about Raymond, Isidore's brother, and his predilection for getting people pregnant and then abandoning them. Well, there was a person named Harry Crosby, and I don't know if you came across him at all. He, by all accounts, you and I could spend 2 hours just talking about Harry Crosby, but there was this woman that wrote a book about her time with Raymond and this whole cult. And this woman was pregnant and Harry Crosby paid for this woman's abortion. And Harry Crosby was an American who was living over there also in a very, I'm going to have sex with everybody I can kind of life. His uncle was J.P. Morgan. So Crosby was living, in an apartment that in today's dollars cost about $50,000 a month. So he had a lot of money and he was sleeping with everybody. And the reason I bring him up is he, ended up marrying this woman who was already married to an alcoholic or something. And it caused this huge scandal in Boston. And oh my gosh. You know, it's this woman who's about 6 years older. She had a couple kids and the town was aghast. Well, you know, this guy, Crosby, he died and he died in a murder suicide, with another woman that he was sleeping with who thought that she was going to be somebody big with him and more permanent and apparently not. And so she was upset and killed him and then shot herself.
Wow. No, I did not read that, but it is very interesting.
Yeah, and it was in the Savoy Plaza Hotel or something like that. I don't know, but it was just a little side note to just, you know, J.P. Morgan and a nephew and just another person who was just living.
I like anything to do with the J.P. Morgan family. You know, anything to do with the Titanic and him taking out other bankers. Anything to do with that family is also very interesting.
I could honestly talk about not so much the death for hours and hours, but you know, just the whole dark magic. It feels there's just something really, really dark in her life. And I think that it was Mary who just kind of ingratiated herself, was somebody who I think admired Isidore Duncan and wanted to be close and just kind of, took over her life and just wanted to control her, and maybe at some point was jealous or something. And it just,
Tell they were jealous. They kept isolating her, you know, making her feel like she couldn't be with the director guy, she couldn't be with the dance production guy, and giving her reasons why, and also running him off with black magic rituals.
Yeah.
So I don't think that you are.
I think Mary was talking about herself as the vamp. I think she was talking about herself.
And I
that
do too.
She put some kind of curse. And I honestly think that back in 1910, when she and Aleister Crowley started hooking up and being together for a year, and then all these bad things started happening to Isadora, I think that they're totally related. Again, curses are just, you know, things in your mind and manifesting it. But at the same time, if you have the world's greatest manipulator just pounding stuff into your head every single day, and then Mary, who is apparently just as good at it as Aleister, doing the same thing every single day, and you have Mary's kid, Preston Sturges, saying, we're lucky to have escaped with our lives, you kind of think that, all right, you know, there's something to this, and whether or not, you know, she actually murdered her, she made her life a living hell.
Yeah, she murdered her spirit, basically, before anyone actually murdered
there
her
you
physically.
Go. There
yeah,
you go.
The mind control, they broke her, and they owned her.
That is perfect. You summed it up. They murdered her spirit. That is a good way to end it. Anyway, thank you for being on this week, and I can't wait to see what we find next week.
Yeah, me either. Good night.
Have a great week. Night.